From beach towels to tea towels, and from mugs to water bottles, the TNT Shop has it all. Browse our shop now at tntradio.live. No propaganda, no lies, and definitely no BS. You're with George Eliason on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to our second hour. Lee Stranahan's agreed to carry over, and we're going to be going further with the Bill Browder story. And also, this is a great lesson in terms of how the media works today. What are facts? What is evidence? What is narrative? How do all these things kick together? Now, before the break, we were covering a Glenn Beck story. And Glenn did a big story on an American terrorist, but he can only go so far because of his religion. Now, Lee, you said that the Mormons have a thing against Russia. Do you know that story? Are you familiar with it?
What? Well, so for one thing, it's about the Mormons were provided funding by the Magnitsky Act. If you check the funding, you'll see some of it came from the Church of Latter-day Saints. So They're on the record as supporting that anti-Russian act. That's one thing. But it has to do with, I think, the fact that Russia, against a number of religions, newer religions, the Seventh-day Adventists, the Jehovah's Witnesses, and the Mormons, have not upheld the degree of religious freedom they want. So I'll put it like that, because I'm in favor of religious freedom by and large, but I understand
it actually goes further back than that. At the beginning of Mormonism, the Rothschilds actually funded that.
That's interesting.
Spread of it.
That's interesting.
What was also happening at the same, a little bit later, was the Rothschilds were actually part of the funding Lenin was looking to, but they felt betrayed. Now, with the Church of Latter-day Saints, you have an entirely new religion. It's not Christianity. It's like Christianity, but it's not Christianity.
Right.
Their eschatology, the end of days start, it's a political eschatology based inside the prophecy of George Washington. But the United States at the end of days must fight and defeat Russia. And they need to do this to get to the Mormon version of paradise or Garden of Eden at the end of time. And so it's not a hate of Russia. It's an existential need to actually start the war and get it over.
And I didn't know some of the history, but it makes perfect sense to me, because I get the feeling there's something else going on here. And you summed it up well, George. But I know Mormons come up all throughout Russiagate.
Well, that's the why. Anything to get this done. Even, the whole Cold War, that's why they were one of the greatest resources the CIA had during the Cold War. Now we're doing our thing. Okay, it's almost time. We're doing our thing. It's the end of days. We'll get to paradise. Why didn't anybody ever think this was dangerous?
And the FBI like recruiting Mormons. Yeah. Yes.
And that's the why. And it's a political religion in a very, very large sense. And that's the take that it has from coming out of Frankist religions over in Eastern Europe, Central Europe. So
that's interesting. Makes a lot of sense.
Well, yeah. At the beginning, one of the theologians actually came. Podolia. That helped define what Mormonism would be. And Podolia was the birthplace of Frankism, Hasidism. It was where the religion of Sabbatai Zvi really took off under Jacob Frank. And you've heard of crypto Jews, all that, crypto Catholics. That's part and parcel with that history, which, you know, it gets into it. Even standing in the exactness of history, here's a date this happened. It just, it flies in the face of reality that, you know, those events could actually happen. People could be taken seriously and have this much effect on history a few hundred years later. But that's what's going on. So you have this natural hate, and it's eschatological. So you're not going to get by it. You're not going to make a treaty that, you know, the Mormons are going to adhere to, we'll say. It's only a matter of convenience, any type of treaty, because they have to get this thing done. You know, it's eschatology. You know, it's like telling a Christian, well, you can't, you know, Satan wins at the end. No, he doesn't. You know, and not fighting Russia is like saying to a Christian, Satan wins at the end. No, he doesn't. And it's just right. That important to them. So when you look at Fox, how shouldn't there be a point where journalists, especially journalists or politicians, make, you know, a statement that, look, let's see.
Well, let me point out briefly, Judge, since I didn't mention it, Fox also paid for lobbying for the Magnitsky Act. Fox is on the record as funding the Magnitsky Act, too. So let me leave that there.
Bada bing. Well, you know, with these things, they know who this guy is. They can't not know who Bill Browder is.
Right. No, 100%. And they know what side he's on. Also, by the way, in the funding, the Church of Scientology, who's also had a lot of problems with the Russians, is on the funding list. The Church of Scientology is an official funder of the Magnitsky Act.
Where's the point where people start signing the waiver saying, listen, you know, I've got skin in this game, so I need to, you know, someone else needs to take over.
I think that Fox owed their viewers an explanation. Any discussions about the Trump Tower meeting should have started by saying Fox News was a financial contributor to Magnitsky Act. They owed it to their viewers ethically to point that out, I think.
Oh, absolutely. If they funded it, absolutely. Did they do it? No.
Never once.
Again, you know, I was listening. Go ahead.
Even NPR does that. If you listen to National Public Radio, they'll say all the time, we are sponsored in part by ExxonMobil or whoever. They'll do that. Mm-hmm. I've never heard Fox say anything about this. And it's all black and white. It's not a debate. They funded it. It's on paper. So, you know, that's why I say Fox is really working at cross purposes here. Fox, no. Because of their funding, is not an objective source at all. They're biased source, anti-Russia.
Mm-hmm. And now, here's the thing. I really don't care. In American news, I really don't care or want a news agency to be pro-Russian. And I hope this makes sense. I don't want them to be pro anything. I want them to report. And news is strictly there to report, this is what happened. Yes, and analysis indeed. Is breaking down, okay, here's what we see. This is behind what happened. Okay, it's not for or against anything per se. And quite frankly, we're missing that right now in news altogether, because we have these perspectives that are based on emotion or emotional values. We don't know what's going on. We don't know. We're not even looking. I'm not looking for good guys. I'm not looking for bad guys. I want to know, when I look at something, I want to know what happened. And that's something that we need to make demands on the system about. And I believe that's part of the reason why you launched this citizen journalism school. Am I right or wrong?
Well, that is right. And increasingly, this citizen journalism thing has become teaching people self-defense, how to guide against you being shut down or being demonetized or being censored in general. So it's changed in the past few years. What I have to teach people, it's no longer just enough to learn about how to blog or how to podcast or whatever. You need to learn how to do so and not get taken out. Does that make sense, George?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, perfect. I've been taken out all over the place. I can tell you all about that end of it. But, you know, I look at it, well, it is what it is. You know, they get it done. Well, they won that one. I'll get the next one. But with what you're doing, yeah, that's kind of invaluable, especially people starting out. Most definitely, because once, you know, you go into it and you think, well, as long as I line up the facts, as long as I'm honest and I know what I'm talking about, I'll be fine. And it's just not the case anymore.
No. And I found even defamation law is pretty stretched. I was sued along with Alex Jones and Jim Hoff from Gateway Pundit by a guy who was a former State Department employee who was at Charlottesville. And I had said he worked for the State Department. That's all I said about him. I didn't say anything inaccurate at all. And still, mm-hmm. I faced a defamation suit. And on paper, he shouldn't have been able to get anywhere with that suit, because I didn't say anything wrong. Didn't right. matter. Alex Jones was a co-defendant. So I got, you know, at a time when they're trying to destroy Alex Jones, I'm just bundled in as the guy who works for Russia. So he was able to, and again, anyone who knows defamation law would say, well, how does he have a case? And the answer is he doesn't, but they no longer need to have a case anymore. We're seeing this over and over again, George. So you're right. Even the truth is not sufficient to defend you.
Well, how do we get it to the, you know, how do we bring things back to the point where it does, because it does matter. Regardless of what anyone says, you can't live in a post-truth society. I mean, God forbid, you know, what does that even mean? You know, oh, the sky is yellow. Really? Wow. You know, what does it even mean, a post-truth society? If we're not demanding. Go ahead.
Well, I end up defending Putin more than I want to, but you have to understand how much his operation was about defaming Putin purposely. Again, they need to create a story about Putin that is crazy and that he might do something like bomb his own nuclear power plant or own gas pipeline. So, for instance, the Litvinenko story has been told about Putin for years, about a Russian double agent who was supposedly killed in London at a sushi place. Now, do you know where that story came from? The Litvinenko story?
Wasn't it a Russian oligarch living in London?
Well, the guy who said it was Putin who did Litvinenko years ago was named Christopher Steele.
Oh, here we go.
Think about that, George. What does that tell you? That Steele's been on the team for years, right?
I wasn't paying attention to it enough back then. And quite frankly, this is the first time I've heard the connection. And yeah, it's actually fitting. Chris Steele, yeah.
Well, let me give you another one. The other guy who's written a lot about Litvinenko is a guy named David Satter, S-A-T-T-E-R. And you can find multiple articles he's written about it. David Satter attended Oxford in the 1960s, and his roommate was a guy named Bill Clinton in 1969. So again, you see what I'm saying? I don't think it's an accident that Strobe Talbot ex roommate, David Satter, and he does it on the right. He bills himself as a conservative, and he's the guy telling Litvinenko's story to people on the right for years. He's the expert on it. And again, he goes back to Clinton, 69, Oxford. So these are the kind of things that I notice, that these narratives about Putin, that story about Putin being the richest guy in the world, that's from Browder. And he's never proved it. He just says it, and him saying it gets it out there in the world and then gets repeated.
Right. It should just kind of destroy the credibility of it. They tried to prove this in how many different cases? They tried to prove this. They finally got it, and then they have nothing, which is actually pretty crazy. We've got to take a quick break, Lee. We'll be right back. I'm George Eliason. We have Lee Stranahan with us today. And I'll see you after these messages.
You should hear what Shannon Joy is talking about.
The Iranian people's fight for liberty in that country.
It is 43 years of oppression and tyranny. Dictatorship, murder, thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of innocent lives taken just basically because they wanted their basic rights. Over and over in the last 43 years, people of Iran have tried to set themselves free, even though a lot of them are my generation, meaning they never felt or experienced the freedom, but they are looking for it. But the biggest problem is every time they try to do that, the Western government, Western media goes absolutely dark on them. Guess what? They can't do it on their own. You know why? I'm going to take a moment here to possibly piss off some people, because they don't have our Second Amendment. In last 4 days, the order shoot to kill has been placed in Iran. They are fighting bare hand while bullets flying at them. So that is what this revolution, these repeated try and attempt is about. Give me freedom or give me death. That's what they've been fighting for.
The Shannon Joy Show on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Affordable housing, we can build that. Sustainable housing, we can build that. At MIT Modular, we understand the importance of housing for all and the importance of design, cost, and functionality. Our goal is to meet the needs of our growing population by converting shipping containers to livable units. If you're like-minded and in a position to invest in something meaningful and life-changing, we want to hear from you. We are a team of professional architects, engineers, and financial and tax experts dedicated to offering unique solutions that provide a brighter future. Our Opportunity Zone Fund offers investors both real estate and operating business diversification, 5-year tax deferral on capital gains, annual tax benefits, and ultimately tax-free appreciation potential. There are Opportunity Zones all over America. If you're interested in learning more about our services, need affordable housing, or want to participate in creating a new vision for tomorrow, give us a call in the U.S. on 385-985-5702. Or read more at mitmodular.com. MIT Modular. We can build that.
Government couldn't stop a flu-like virus.
And now they want you to believe they can stop the Earth's climate from changing?
The voice of reason is TNT Radio.
Welcome back and happy weekend. We've got Lee Stranahan coming back and we're discussing Russia, media, Bill Browder. We're across the board with this thing. The other point that he's made, and he really, last time you were on, Lee, you really made this point. It was actually to the where it was chilling with in around the Clintons, just how tight a circle it actually is, because everybody, oh, he's involved with this. Oh, well, he went to school with them this year, that year. Oh, they did this with that. I mean, all of them, Shearers, Talbot, everybody.
Right. These are the people who are the Clintons' oldest and closest political friends. These are people who have known the Clintons since Bill Clinton, since 69. Strobe Talbot mm-hmm. knew Bill Clinton before Hillary knew Bill Clinton.
Now
that's how far Talbot goes back, pre-Hillary.
And Hillary's, you know, a lot of people don't realize that Hillary's ties to the neocons goes pretty deep too.
Right.
You know, they think she's just a total. You know, it's a Democratic Party thing, but the neocons, we call, you know, you can label it rhinos today because neocons kind of going out, you know, with the bathwater. But these are all people from the same political guild. Would that be a thing?
Well, a lot of them have a basis in leftist politics. Hillary Clinton mm-hmm. did her master's essay on Saul Alinsky and knew Saul Alinsky personally, corresponded with him, kept in touch with him. And so that's Hillary's bona fides. She also worked as the legal assistant for the Black Panthers when they were on trial in New Haven for murder and kidnapping. But Hillary's got the background. But Bill was obviously ran for attorney general and governor of Arkansas, which is a conservative state. So Hillary Clinton went from working for a communist law firm to about 3 years later working for a pro-death penalty governor and attorney general. Mm-hmm. And the people at Truhaf Bernstein, the communist law firm she dealt with, were shocked that a person who was anti-death penalty so quickly became, but it's classic neoliberal. Does that make sense? Liberal
yeah, that makes
background
perfect sense.
A little bit. Right. And so it's a pattern you see. And Derek Scherer, we talked about before, Derek Scherer's wife was the first socialist mayor of the city of Santa Monica. And I believe he was in the SDS, Derek Scherer. So a lot of them have roots in the classic 60s, you know, leftist groups, the SDS, the Panthers, mm-hmm. and so on. But they're neoliberals. But they're, you know, if they were committed socialists at some point, they sold that out very quickly.
Well,
does that make sense?
You've got the Bolshevik socialism, Lenin, but you've also have the Austro-socialism, Austro-fascism, which I think is closer to what these people actually believe. Now, when you're...
I think they learned a lot from Alinsky, too. Alinsky is a guy who said, basically, cut your hair, put on a tie, and you'll get further than if you're going with a beard and leather jacket. He was a practical political realist. And you can see that Bill Clinton listened to that lesson. Bill Clinton cut his hair, put on a suit, and then he got elected in Arkansas. So I think, obviously, Alinsky was a factor. He was a communist who believed in practical union organizing. And, you know, the hippies hated him because he said, don't dress like a hippie and you'll go further. Well, Clinton took that lesson to heart, I think.
Now, this is going to be just the question itself might make you crazy. You have all these former socialists, former communists, former this, that, the other thing, isms. Why do they hate Putin so much?
They're somewhat forced to, because they want to take over Russia's oil and natural gas assets. Once they decided that Putin wasn't going to play ball, again, look at the contrast with Yeltsin. The same oligarchs put Putin into place. That's true. But Putin very quickly proved that he was not going to just go along with the oligarchs' agenda. He's a patriot. He loves Russia. And also, I just think he's a stronger person than that. Yeltsin obviously had his problems. And once they realized Putin was not going to be a pushover, they had to take him out because they couldn't buy him out.
And now, this is a follow-up to that because people get confused because of how these things are portrayed in media. Is Vladimir Putin a socialist? Does Russia have a real desire to restart the Soviet Union again?
No.
You know,
Putin said explicitly stuff. You know, Putin takes an interesting position because the U.S. is, in a sense, dealing with the problem, a struggle with it in all sorts of ways. We have a history of slavery, obviously, in the U.S. And Putin also has a history. He's got the history of Stalin and communism in his country, right? And a lot of people were killed in the gulags and so on. And Putin's an admirer of Solzhenitsyn. So he knows all about that history. But unlike a lot of American leaders who curl themselves up in guilt about slavery, but don't actually do anything about it, they'd never be in favor of reparations, for instance, as a practical matter, but they wring their hands and act guilty about slavery. Putin takes the attitude, Russia's got a background, some bad things happened in this period, and I'm not going to defend them, but I'll just say, but I'm not going to feel guilty about them. And it's very interesting contrast the way the U.S. handles it. Putin acknowledges the problems that happened in the Bolshevik era, but also he does something that no American leader can do. He can point out the good things that the Bolsheviks did, because obviously there are some good things that the communists, you know, for instance, the Soviet army defeating the Nazis. That's one good example. So I don't know if this makes sense, but I feel he deals with it in a sane way. In a sane way. You acknowledge the mistakes of the past flatly, but you don't tie yourself up feeling overly guilty about them because you can't change them and you didn't do them anyway. Does that make sense, George?
Yeah, it does. And the other thing, and this is something that, you know, when we look at Ukraine today, okay, we're looking at, you have pre-1991, you have Soviet Ukraine. Then you have post-Soviet Ukraine, whatever that became, okay? And then you have post-Orange Revolution Ukraine, which wasn't very much different. It was negligible. But then you have post-Maidan, which is a brand new era and brand new country in a lot of different ways.
Indeed.
Are we looking at, you look at Tsarist Russia, the Soviet Union, and the Russian Federation. Now, these are three entirely different entities on the same land, yes, but different formulations. Why would they be responsible for what was before them? You know, in terms of what you just said about Putin's view, I mean, does that establish it? Or am I being, I don't know, too close-sighted or childish in my view, politically, well, on that count?
Yeah, I was once talking to Peter Lavelle from RT's Crosstalk, and I'd been on the show, and I was just talking to Peter on the phone casually afterwards, because he lives in Russia, and I'm interested in that. And so I asked him about what I noticed about Russia's attitude, Russian's attitude, I should say. And he said something very interesting to me, which I've confirmed with other people who are American and moved to Russia. Russia, he said, ideology has not worked out well for Russia. So Russians tend to be less ideological and much more practical. They care more what are you doing for me, or then what's this ideology about? And Americans are very much ideology. You know, that's why you get Biden saying things like freedom or democracy. He talks all day about democracy, but he can do nothing at all to defend democracy. It's all just words. And right. Russians and Putin puts his money where his mouth is. He's much more interested in showing results than trying to sell you on ideology. And I think that's very distinct from what we're used to in the US and the UK.
That was one of the most striking features of moving here. When I came here, this is, you're going 2009, 2010. I moved to Ukraine, and originally, I lived in West Central Ukraine, right on the Moldovan border. And I knew that guy Putin lived, you know, he's only one border away. So, you know, as much as I can, I'm keeping a watchful eye on that guy Putin. Well, they have a lot of disasters in Russia that first summer and the second summer. Wildfires, crops are burning, towns are burning. And you hear about the Russian government jumping in, rebuilding the town, taking care of everything, taking care of the people, businesses, whatever, everything. They rebuilt it. And so at first you're like, well, okay, well, you know, he's getting a propaganda push in media, you know. But then it happens for the third time. And then there's a couple other things, and they're handling that too, him and Medvedev. And it's just nonstop. He's, you know, they're always locally in the media, but it's always because they're doing something. You know, and it's popping up all over the country for a reason, not just to be there to talk to people. And I just, over time, it really, it kind of wore down my, I was just really, I wouldn't say I was anti-Russian, but I was very, very negative in how I viewed this government had to be, because honestly, came out of the Soviet Union after all, right? Well, over time, the only conclusion you can come up with is, wow, he's a really good leader. You know, Russia may not be perfect, but, and they say that it's an imperfect democracy, but they're always in the game. You always hear about, you know, corruption because they're fighting corruption. You know, if you don't hear about corruption, no one's fighting it.
Here's an observation I've had, George. The thing about this, you know the history here. Of Europe, there's two leaders I can think, and I'm including Russia and Europe, who are popular. Most leaders are Macron, Schultz, obviously in England. They're unpopular leaders. There are two countries with popular, polling says a lot of their voters like them. Who are they? Putin and Orban, right? Is that fair to say? And basically, they're the only two leaders in Europe who are popular with the people. Does that make sense? Now, what do Putin and Orban both have in common? About 20 years ago or so, maybe more, but they got rid of George Soros. He was kicked out of Russia and Hungary, and his organization was kicked out. And I think if you look at it that way, part of what Soros does by building up a group of a network of NGOs that are connected is he erases popular support for the leader of that country. And if you get rid of the propaganda that comes from an NGO network, white papers, educational programs, art, and so on, all the stuff that civil society does. If you get rid of that, you see that civil society is a massive propaganda operation. And I think it's not an accident that the two countries that got rid of Soros have popular leaders. Does that make any sense, George?
Yeah. Yeah, it does.
Because I think people don't understand how much the NGO networks play in propaganda. They have so much to do with propaganda.
Well, when 1991 came around, the Ukrainian diaspora, one of the main sources of employment for them was the CIA. They did analysis. They did street level CIA operative stuff inside the Soviet Union, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they had connections all over the world. Afterwards, right away, as soon as that wall fell, as soon as Ukraine was declared a free state, they went to the humanitarian causes and started the all the color revolutions is where it ended up right away. So that's the kind of people that were killing people for their, you know, political views 2 years before that were saying who was worthy to live and run a government after that. You know, that not much of a switch. So you have Soros backing him on that now.
Well, and let me point out something that you're a great researcher, George. You'll like this. There's a guy who worked for Prologue Corporation. Prologue was a CIA-funded company in the U.S. that did pro-Ukrainian Nazi propaganda, right?
Right.
You know who Prologue was. So
yeah,
Prologue was a CIA-funded company. So a guy who worked for Prologue wrote a memoir a few years ago. And it's one of these books that no one read. Five Ukrainians read it. In other words, it's his memoir telling a story. But, you know, it's got a small audience because he's not a big famous person. So in this biography, though, while working for Prologue, he recruited George Soros. He recruited George Soros to go into Ukraine. So in other words, the CIA recruited Soros. And this guy admits it in his memoir. It's right there. He says it plainly. He says, we met with Soros and we recruited him. And he's with Prologue, which is CIA. So it's right out. But because it's in a memoir that's very obscure, no one ever talks about it. Did you know that? But a guy who worked for...
I didn't know any of this.
Yeah. And again, it's plain English. He admits it. I'll send you a reference afterwards.
Thank you.
It's one of those things where a friend of mine who's obsessive, he had picked up this memoir for like $60 on Amazon as a used book. Does that make sense? You know the kind of book I'm talking about, an obscure memoir.
Yeah, I do.
And so this guy who's obsessive and a friend of mine picked it up, and sure enough, he struck gold.
That's just crazy.
Yeah. And you know, as a researcher, that can happen sometimes. You find something obscure, and then you go, what's this guy admitting to? He's admitting to recruiting Soros and going over the conversation? Because that's what happens.
Well, because of the geography Soros came out of, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Ukrainians were at that point the other part of that empire. It was the same empire. We've got to take a quick break, Lee. We'll be back in a couple of minutes. This is George Eliason with TNT Talk Radio.
The midterms and America votes on November 8th.
With his expert analysis and opinion,
this is TNT Radio's Timothy Shea.
In a race critical to GOP hopes of regaining control of the United States Senate next January, former Nevada Attorney General Adam Laxalt is leading incumbent Democrat Senator Catherine Cortez Masto 47-43% with 4.5% remaining undecided in the latest Trafalgar poll of likely voters. Laxalt, the son of former New Mexico Senator Pete Domenici and grandson of former Nevada Governor and U.S. Senator Paul Laxalt, is seen as one of the GOP's best hopes at flipping a seat from Democrat to Republican. Meanwhile, next door, GOP Senate nominee Blake Masters is reminding Arizonans of Democrat incumbent Senator Mark Kelly's racist joke 4 years ago when he said of his twin brother, former astronaut Scott Kelly, that he was DNA challenged, half a howler monkey, half an orangutan, and that they had changed his name to Rodrigo. Really? Rodrigo? Why Rodrigo? From MAGAInstitute.com, this is Timothy Shea for TNT Radio.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative. This is Viewpoint.
The trusted news initiative, TNI, is described as a means for news organizations to rebuild trust and tackle the next disinformation challenges. The BBC's Trusted News Initiative is a partnership that includes First Draft, Google, YouTube, Twitter, Reuters, Meta, The Washington Post, Microsoft, Associated Press, Agence France-Presse, Financial Times, EBU, and Nation Media Group. The BBC website states it is the only forum in the world of its kind designed to take on disinformation in real time. 2 weeks after the World Health Organization announced the COVID-19 pandemic, on March the 11th, 2020, Canada's CBC reported that TNI had announced plans to tackle harmful coronavirus disinformation. Censoring organizations refer to the WHO, CDC, FDA, and NIH policies to justify their censorship. Other subjects of suppression by TNI now include the Russia-Ukraine conflict, climate change, elections and democracy, and many others.
The news everyone is talking about. TNT Radio, where the longer you listen, the more reasons you find to keep listening. Lighting the fuse for freedom. TNT Radio.
We're with Lee Stranahan today, and we're actually getting into the origins of, you're not going to believe it, George Soros. And where does he start off with? The Ukrainians, Bandera. Yeah. I mean, does any evil not emanate from this political group? What do you think, Lee? This is just crazy.
Well, it started me thinking about Soros differently. when I saw that he was recruited by the CIA, I see him now essentially as a CIA asset. And it makes perfect sense that what he do. And the reason I say that is because the CIA has long been in the propaganda business, but some things changed in the propaganda business, because when you went from the world of media controlled by the Times and the Post and three networks into cable news and then small press publications and then blogging and so on, the way you do propaganda necessarily needed to change. And it went from essentially what I'll call a centralized model. Mockingbird was about getting assets in at a few publications. Does that make sense? But in the modern world, you can't just do that anymore. You have to have people in everywhere. And you have to have organizations that are fact checkers and that do white papers and that do protests and so on. And this all needs to be coordinated. So the new world of propaganda is NGO-based. Does that make sense? So when they needed a new world, they brought in Soros to set up a network of NGOs in Ukraine. And by doing that, the CIA roughly controlled all the messaging among those NGOs. And you've seen, I've made the argument that the Banderites, the Nazis in Ukraine, were kept going by the U.S. and Canada. They would have died out had it not been for the U.S. and Canada, because there was not popular support for them in Ukraine. But they were able to keep the diaspora going. The Banderites were able to stay in Canada and the U.S. with the backing of the CIA and the Canadian government. Does that make sense? I'm convinced that the Banderas would not Ukraine. Yeah. So that's the point I want to make there, George.
Well, they, you know, I think it was 1947 when they declared the beginning of the Cold War is when they became important. And both, you know, they actually recognized it was the U.S. first as an initiative, but they recognized the Ukrainian government in exile, whatever that was going to be.
Exactly right.
And then they funded it. Literally funded. Go ahead.
The guy who connects to a lot of stuff, believe it or not, is Joe Biden. In the 80s, here's what was happening with Ukraine. Do you remember the story? It was a big one in the U.S. So about Ivan the Terrible, the concentration camp guard, Jadimyan. Right. So at the time, that made 60 Minutes and stuff like that. And there was a lot of press about these awful, sadistic Ukrainian guards. Remember that?
Yeah.
Ukraine.
Yeah, dude.
Ukrainian diaspora did not like that. The Banderas did not like that at all. And even Reagan had said stuff against the Nazi Ukrainian guards. Remember that? And you may remember that. Reagan spoke out against them. And when he did that, the Ukrainian diaspora turned on Reagan. And who was there to take their hand? Joe Biden, a young Democrat senator. Joe Biden starting meeting with people about how awful the Republicans were for bringing up the Nazi guards. And so Biden made a lot of alliances with the Ukrainian diaspora in the 80s.
This I didn't
meeting
know.
With. Yes. And one of the people I met with was a guy named Vivitsky. Now, Vivitsky is I think he's based in New Jersey, but he's an American Ukrainian with some background in law. And when recently, now Joe Biden was meeting with this guy in the 80s. And then when Joe Biden got the prosecutor general thrown out, Remember that? Mm-hmm. When he withheld the money. One of the people that they were talking about replacing him was Vavitsky. And Biden actively talked about that at the time. Maybe it should be this guy Biden had known since the 80s. So you see how these same players come up over and over again.
Yeah, that's actually, I had no idea about any of that at all.
And then I found a picture. I found a picture of a Ukrainian conference that was held in Kyiv or somewhere a few years ago. And standing next to Babitsky was, you guessed it, Alexander Zhuruba.
Mm-hmm. No doubt there. Chalupa comes from diaspora royalty of some sort. And, you know, that where her parents were during the war itself is, you know, I'm not clear on. But the fact that they're royalty of some sort.
Do you know much about her mother?
Really clear. I don't. I actually
don't. So the maiden name is Kais. And Kais, if you look in the CIA records, her brother was a CIA asset in the 50s. I'll say that again. Alexander Chalupa's mother, Kais, her brother was a CIA asset who's listed in the CIA papers at the CIA archive.
Oh.
Does that make sense? So in the 50s.
Yeah, I might have a story about him you might be interested in.
Yes. So this is.
Go ahead.
He's one of those people who went through the German camps after World War II, the relocation camps for Ukrainians.
Mm-hmm.
He was at those camps.
I'm very familiar.
And there seemed to have been a lot of recruiting from there.
Yeah, and you might be familiar. We've only got a few minutes left, and I'd like to leave it on this because it's something that, you know, people should start to think about. You might have heard of a guy named, you know, a little guy, a really obscure guy named George Orwell. He had something to say about 1984 or something. He was best friends with this guy. Matter of fact, he dedicated his book, Animal Farm, to the Bandera that were at those camps. And there's only 5 copies in existence, and Andrea Chalupa has the copy that he gave to her uncle.
Well, her father, Leo Chalupa, is a physician and was at George Washington University. And his name was on the list given to the whistleblower under Delzenko while working at the embassy as someone to keep in touch with. So Leo Chalupa is obviously involved in this operation in some way. And I've noticed there's a lot of intergenerational stuff. I'm sure you've noticed this. People whose uncles or fathers or grandfathers were Nazis, their kids are Nazi Ukrainians. Have you noticed that?
Right, they're brought up that way. Yeah, it's on
exactly
purpose.
Right. And they go to Saturday schools as children or whatever.
Yep, and they're literally, their talents are actually fleshed out and they're pushed to go into areas where they can serve the interests of nationalist Ukraine, the Nazi Ukraine. And they're.
And once I realized it was an accident. Yeah, and once you realize that, you start to figure out a lot of stuff. A lot of things fall into place when you go, it's consistent that it's intergenerational. It's one generation raised by a previous generation who is a Nazi. Does that make sense, George?
Yeah, and the other part of it, we've only got a couple minutes left, that they came here in their military formations. That's the scary part. Lee, what is the best place to find you? So we, listeners can do that right now?
Well, in general, my last name, Stranahan, on Twitter, I do a lot of things, and I link to most of them through Twitter. So that's the best place to find my stuff. Although I have a new webpage going up, but when that's up, I'll announce that on Twitter. So Twitter's a good place to follow me.
Thanks for coming by today, Lee. This has been great. I look forward to having you back again.
Of course, George. And again, I'm a big admirer of yours, as you know. So thank you for all the great work you've done. And hopefully I've given you a few things to think about.
You've given a lot to think about. Thank you so much for this. We really need to talk about some of these things.